not him. It's my story.
Yeah,
because I picked up the website. Oh, you saw the video that you
brought
in sessions up.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. The electrical tutorials are likely to all be in the same range within 5 hours. So, which is a long unit classroom called a unit science paper.
This has been a particularly lucrative day for fines in lecture theatres.
Oh, good. Hardly need to pay you a salary with all of that.
Absolutely not.
Amazing.
How are you doing? Okay.
Bearing up. Oh my God, no I'm not. I just realised I forgot my dongle for this. I have to go back to informatics. It's a Mac thing, you need a special.
Of course.
Okay, maybe we can start. Sorry to be a little bit late. I'm just getting accustomed to owning a Macintosh. And if you own a Macintosh, you know when you do these presentations, you need that extra little connector that connects you to the VGA. I'm still in PC mode, so I haven't quite got used to being able to remember to take that across. So I had to nip away and collect that. Okay, so, another thing just before we start. For various reasons outside my control, I'm not going to be able to be around for the lecture tomorrow. So you have a lecture off tomorrow, which you can use for catching up on all the bits and pieces that I've been doing. Yes, hooray. Yeah, I know. And then we'll just pick it up again on the Thursday. So, okay, negation. Actually, this will give you something to pick up on the Friday, actually. Actually, it's quite nice in a way to have a wee bit of a break there, because where we're going to be at by the end of this lecture is pretty much we'll have gone through the basics of propositional logic, we'll have gone through truth tables, you'll have seen a bit of sequent calculus, so those rules that you saw in the previous lecture, and now I'm going to give you, I'm giving you the second lecture of that now, which is to talk a little bit about negation, and you're going to get more proof rules and how to deal with those. So by the time we've got to 12 o'clock, you'll have all the basics for doing the sequent calculus stuff. And then there's just a raft of exercises that you can do to get a little bit of practice yourself in that. There's the tutorials. And yeah, do practice the tutorials before you come into the tutorial, and then you can have a good tutorial talking about that stuff. WebCT, actually, let me ask another question before I get going, since I'm now starting to think about this. How many of you already know how to handle WebCT, that kind of thing? Because you've taught everybody. Okay, so the WebCT issue is sorted out for you, and you can how many of you know how to access and use the stuff for Informatics 1 computational logic on WebCT already? So there's nothing much more that we need to do there. Would that be correct? Even if you're somebody who doesn't know, you can ask a friend who does. So I don't need to set up anything special for that. I don't want anybody to feel sidelined that you don't have the material, because there's lots of material there for you to use, sort of thing where you can get immediate feedback on what you're doing. Right, multi-choice tests that you can use, they will give you feedback, your tutors will give you feedback, and so on. So there should be nobody left behind in understanding the nuts and bolts of the stuff I'm describing here. That's normally true every year, so I'm just making sure. I think that's all under control from what I can tell. If it's not under control, if you've got some sort of problem with being able to access WebCT or some other problem that's connected with a bit of the course that you're finding difficult to do or something. Tom French is the teaching assistant on that. I mentioned him in the first lecture. You could always mail him if there's something that means something that's not going to, your tutor can't help with in that respect. Good. Okay. So negation. So I hope you remember from the previous lecture where I was talking about sequent calculus and how to do those kinds of proofs. We're going to do one or two more. And I'll be talking to you a little bit about how you handle negation, how you handle saying things are not true in logical systems. It's really quite a difficult and deep issue to deal with. So this is one of those areas where all we're going to do is touch on it a little bit. You get an idea of how to handle some basic kinds of negation. There's lots, lots more that you can do. A little bit later in the course, we'll be using negation in a slightly different way when we come to talk about resolution proofs, but that's something for later. For now, just concentrate on negation in the sentence I'll give you here. I'll also be talking, as usual, I'll be doing a standard example just to give you something for your brain to chew on as we're going through the more abstract stuff. And I'll talk about perceptrons this time. Now, when we come to talk about perceptrons, actually, I will be using negation, but mostly what that will be doing is having a look again at how you represent things in logic, because I think it's good for you to see, you know, little examples of how you do slightly larger tasks using logic as a representation language. So that's what we'll do, and I'll make some points about the limitations of proofs with negation. Okay, so here's the problem. And as you've probably guessed by now, I'm deliberately trying to choose problems that are in different parts of informatics. So we've seen ones that were connected with databases. We've seen ones that are connected with distributed internet type things. We're seeing ones now that are connected with the problem of being able to learn using very simple components. So for a very, very long time, almost as long as informatics has existed, I suppose, as a sort of technical field, people have worried about how to be able to get the similar sort of learning and problem-solving performance out of things that don't have the structure of one of these directly. In other words, ones where you aren't sort of dividing things up into components and subcomponents and big complicated subroutines. Because if you actually, you know, if you start looking inside things like human brains, then you don't find that structure. What you find is something that's, it's quite complex structure, but it's a different structure. And it relies a lot on lots and lots of, well, and the standard story one often tells is lots and lots of simple components connected very, very densely. Of course, that is nowhere near the whole story. Because the more people start looking at the human brain, the more they start to discover that there are actually very important nuances of structure inside the human brain. And actually, that's an area where you look and you keep looking and you keep finding more and more to actually understand. Oh, by the way, we have one of the big centers in neuroinformatics in UK, Europe, in informatics. So, and there's a doctoral training center on neuroinformatics in the organization in which you are studying. So just a little plug for that. Most of those guys aren't working with perceptrons, because perceptrons is quite an old idea. But I think it's a nice old idea to talk about, and it gives me a chance to talk about using logic for things where you wouldn't really have thought you would want to use logic. So here's a perceptron, world's simplest little component that you could use. So you have to imagine what you want to do is to build something that's going to learn. It's going to be able to sense things about the environment somehow. And those will be little input wires. The input wires will just signal zeros or ones. They're either active or they're inactive. So here's your little component. It's got lots of wires coming in. They're either going to be sending a signal in, they're active. Let's say that's a one. Or they're inactive. It's a zero. And it's going to have one output. And that output is going to be either zero or one. Right? And these guys coming in are going to have weights on them. So you can differentiate how much, how the amount that you want to pay attention to the inputs that are coming in. So you can differentiate those. So you put a weight on these input signals. Okay. And you also have, actually, normally this is done by having in an undifferentiated way, but I've differentiated here. There's a threshold which you can set. And the reason for the threshold is so that this acts as a little step function. Let me explain to you how the step function works. So just to reiterate, the I's are inputs. They're 0, 1. O is the output, 0, 1. The W's are the weights, 0 to 1. You can set anywhere between 0 and 1. T is some threshold that you set, some number. And then the way this thing works is very simple. You just take the sum of the weighted inputs, you apply the weights to each input and sum them, minus the threshold, and that's going to be and then you apply a threshold function on that to give you the output. And the threshold function says if that expression is less than or equal to zero, then it outputs zero. If that expression is greater than zero, it outputs one. Okay? So really, really, really very, very simple. Bunch of inputs, weight it. If you're sending enough signals, modulo the weights, so you exceed the threshold, bang, that thing activates. That's it. That's a perceptron. Okay? You understand that component completely. World sim- oh, question.
What's meant by
th? Oh, I'm sorry. Th is the function given this. This is going to be some number. Okay, so it's the weight of all of these minus the threshold. That's the bit that's giving you the step. Okay, and th is just a function. And if that expression is less than or equal to zero, th gives you zero. If that expression, so this is the e, this bit here is the e. Okay, say th, e, the expression. So if that guy is less than or equal to zero, zero. If that guy turns out to be greater than zero, one. That's it. Righty ho. Okay, a little bit about training perceptrons. You'll see in a moment why I'm telling you all this. This, in a way, is a little bit of an aside, because we're not going to be doing too much about training perceptrons in this lecture, but I just wanted you to know. Usually they get trained. Usually what happens with these guys is you're interested in problems where you want to train from data. These are the sort of problems where you can't really write an algorithm, but you have something that's capable of learning about different examples. Then eventually you hope you can train it enough that it'll give you a response that's predictable. Many, many systems are now like this. And it's the way that people who are interested in computation
when you can't write the algorithm, you don't understand the problem well enough to write the algorithm, can still get tractions on problems. You invent a generic system that will just learn from the examples. Okay, so you choose a threshold and weights just randomly. And then if that's right, bingo, you hit the lottery, it works. What right means is, given the examples that you're training it on, it's giving you the right input. Given the inputs, it gives you always, every time, the right output. But normally that wouldn't be true right at the beginning. So otherwise, what you do is you choose an example of the wrong input, something that causes it to give the wrong behavior. And if the output's too big, you multiply each input by a small constant, subtract that from the weight, increase the threshold by the same. If the output's too small, you add to the weights and decrease the threshold. You don't have to remember this. I will never examine you on this sort of stuff. Actually, typically, I will never ask you to remember any of the specific problems I'm giving you. They're here for illustrative purposes, just to make this be more interesting for you and to connect it to real things. But basically, what happens here is you guddle around, changing the thresholds and weights and stuff. And the amazing thing is that this eventually converges on certain types of problems. The question is, what sort of behaviors can this possibly give you? So here's a question for you. Imagine you had a perceptron, just one. Could you get the behaviors that you would get with logical connectives, like ands and ors and that sort of thing? It'd be quite nice, because then you could turn them into little logical components. Would that be true? How would you convince yourself whether that was true or false? Okay, so that's the question at the back of your minds when I'm doing this other stuff now, and we'll come back to it. But now I want to talk about negation and proof rules. So remember the proof rules we had before? We had a whole slew of those for proving things like ands and ors and implications and all of that. If you can't remember those, go back and remember them. Either your short-term memory is really short or you're not working hard enough. So you should be able to remember roughly how, not necessarily in detail, but how these go. So the idea is you have a proof that you want to perform, and this is from the set of axioms, gives you a proof of some expression, in this case not A. And then you have the subproofs that you need to perform. You're decomposing the problem down into smaller problems as you go. And I've given you three proof rules connected with negation here, actually. I could have given you more, but actually it turns out three is enough for the examples that I'm going to use for this lecture. At least I think that is. And here are the ones that I'll give you. In a way, what you're trying to do is to rely on a very simple principle, which we will return to actually in resolution. Let me give you the intuitive argument that we're kind of backs this up. And it's really a proof by absurdity. If you and I are having an argument, and you're saying certain things and arguing this and arguing that, and if I can demonstrate to you conclusively that given the axioms that you're using and that the argument that you're making is absurd, in other words, that you're saying something is, say, true and false at the same time, would be a good definition of what it would mean to be absurd in a logical argument. Both are inferable. Then I can show that whatever it is that you're trying to conclude is false, right? By absurdity. It is absurd to believe the following thing. Therefore, whatever its negation will be true. Right? That would be an argument that you would understand. It's the sort of argument that very clever humans making arguments tend to use an awful lot of the time. We haven't seen any like that so far in the lectures. They've all been positive things. I want to prove this positive thing from all this positive information. But quite often you use negation in a constructive way like that. So here are some proof rules that you can use. So if you want, and false here is just a symbol that I'm using to represent the fact that I'm going to have a contradiction in my set of axioms. You'll see later how that works with the other rules. There's nothing. It's just marking the fact that I've got a contradiction. Think of it that way. So suppose this, here's the first bit if you're, when you're wanting to reason in this particular way. So here's my set of axioms. I want to prove that A is not true. So not A means A is false, from given the set of axioms that I got here. Then what I do is I'll add A into the set of axioms. Remember, this is the operator that just stuffs whatever it is that's here into the set of axioms I've got. And from that, I can conclude this false thing. Okay. Now this one says, from my set of axioms, I conclude whatever you like, actually. If the negation of something appears in the set of axioms, and also it's positive, here is the contradiction step. If I can show that I've got a negation in my set of axioms, and then I can derive the logical opposite, then I can prove something in particular, I could prove false. Okay. Last one here says I can prove, this one here is just to introduce double negation, which is sometimes useful, although I don't think I'll be using it in the example. So this says if I want to prove A, another way I can do that is to prove that the negation of A is not true. And you can have more rules for negation. Actually, there's a few more in the notes. Actually, there used to be one more in the slides in the last lecture, but I just used these three now. Okay, so the purpose of all of these is to give you positive evidence for why something is false. In a moment, I'll show you a different way of doing negation, which relies on a completely different style of thinking about the argument. So this is, we've got positive evidence which you can demonstrate through the proof that something is false. And I'm going to give you one example of this. So suppose I know that A is true, and it's not true that A and B are true. I want to be able to conclude that B is not true. And I imagine you can look at that and you just think intuitively, yeah, that you should be able to prove that. Right. So the question is how. Okay. So if A is true and I know that that A and B can both be true, then B can't be true. But we want to prove that. So we can do that if we can show that by putting the negation of B, that is B itself, into the set of axioms. Right, so I added B. I want to show that that not B is true. So let's put B in and show that that's going to generate an absurdity for us. Okay, let's assume that B is true, and I'll show you that that's just rubbish. Okay, so now I've got not A and B is in here, right? So this is the second of the rules of negation that I gave you on the previous slide, is in that set. And now what I'm going to do is, I've got the negation in here, and now I'm going to prove its inverse, that A and B is true. And that one is definitely true, it's trivially true, it appears in the axiom set. This one I now have to go and prove. And if I can prove it, given that I know this is true, I've got an absurdity and I've got this, and therefore that holds. Now this one, now we're back to proof rules that you saw in the previous lecture, because I want to be able to show that A and B are true. Okay, so from B and A and not A and B, I can prove A. That's pretty obvious, because A appears directly in there. And from B and A, not A and B, I can prove B. There we go. And now I have the usual, now, this is the usual, harking back to what I was talking about in the previous lecture. The mechanism of applying the proof rules here is just exactly the same as you saw before, and you know you've got it right in exactly the same way that you knew before, because you just need to make sure that you applied the rules correctly, you've got all of the subproofs that you need to get, and then when you look at the proof tree, my little tree that grows upside down, then all of the leaves of that tree, the terminal nodes on it, are just looking up things in the set of axioms. That one, that one, that one. That's on what the proof depends. And all the rest is derived through my proof rules, and each one of my proof rules I determined was logically sound, therefore the proof holds. Okay, so it's the same. If you've practiced, which I hope you've had time to do, if you haven't, you definitely have time tomorrow. If you've practiced doing some stuff with sequent calculus before, it's the same mechanism. It's just that I've added a few more rules for you to deal with negation. So I haven't really changed the game. It's the game that you know how to play. You should get a little bit of practice just handling it. All it takes, the mechanisms are very simple in some ways. It's just making choices and building this structure. What you need to practice is just the experience of applying them, and I have a question.
So all the steps you've got to show that A's element of that and B's element of that, you need to do all those steps to be able to say that stuff with B, it shows A and it shows B, so that A is an element.
Yeah, well, you need the member... Basically, what you're doing with all of these things, and there are many, 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 I don't know how many, maybe it's new ones are being invented all the time, many, many different proof systems, there are different variants tuned for different tasks, all basically operating in the same way. You're doing problem subdivision by looking at a proof, developing proof rules that you know are sound individually, logically, and if each one is sound individually, then computational logic has this property that you can monotonically push them together. And if each individual link in the chain is sound, you know the whole chain is sound. And then the membership things are just fishing down into the axioms. They're the bit that gives you traction with a specific problem. Another question. Oh, very good question. That's a good question because I forgot to say about this. What he's saying is, suppose this set of axioms that I give you already contained something that was an absurdity. For example, this set of axioms already contained something like contained B, or something like that, or contained even worse, contained B and not B already, or even something else. Actually, it contained P and not P, something that was unconnected with this. What then happens? And the answer is all hell breaks loose, because from that I can still conclude anything at all. So everything, this is a tremendously useful point to make, and I should have actually said it before. Everything that I have told you about the F here makes one big assumption, that it's consistent, right? Okay, so that set of axioms I'm giving you is a consistent set. If everything that I'm building my arguments on is already inconsistent, then these proof rules can potentially, especially with negation in, can start concluding all sorts of things that make no sense, because the arguments at the very base are inconsistent. Okay, so the reason why this... You know, why did this suddenly strike a chord when you said it to me? It wasn't just because for some kind of abstract logical reason. It's because this is a tremendous problem in almost every system that you ever build in your whole life. You may not know it's a problem. It may not exhibit itself in this way. It won't exhibit itself in this way, probably. But it is a huge problem. Most systems actually do have, at some level, inconsistency in them. But an awful lot of systems never hit those inconsistent cases because the computation never explores them. Actually, this is a good link into talking about negation as failure. Let me, having made that point, which doesn't in any way rule out the use of logics, because there's plenty of cases where you can ensure consistency and it makes sense, let me get you onto negation as failure, because sort of we touch on this here too. So negation as failure, the good news for negation as failure is the following thing. You only need one rule. That's it. Okay, so here's the good news. Suppose with negation as failure, I want to prove from some set of axioms that A doesn't hold. Here's my subproof. And this, so now I have to explain to you what this funny little thing with the red line through it means. It means, you actually don't often see it written like this, but I'm writing it like this just to make it simple to understand. This means that I can't find a proof of A from F, no matter how I apply all of my proof rules. I apply my proof rules exhaustively, and I can't find a proof of A. And if I can't do that, it can't be true. Okay? So this makes what's known as the closed world assumption. It means that you're assuming that inside your set of axioms, you have all the axioms that are pertinent to the problem. And if it could logically be concluded, your proof search would find it. So you're saying, if I can, you know, given that I have a proof system, I have things that are going to be concluded by it. Those things that can be concluded by it are true. Those things that could never be concluded by it, I can safely assume to be false, because I have described the whole problem down to some level of detail. And I have a system that will search for any possible way that that a true conclusion could be derived. Okay, and if that is true, then the absence of evidence for its truth can be considered to be its falsity. That's the trick that you're trying to pull. And it massively simplifies the problem of negation. It's the reason why logic programming works. Actually, the irony of logic programming, I hope I'll be able to squeeze in a lecture on logic programming at some point, which for people who've done logic programming is not the sort of stuff you're probably accustomed to. The irony of logic programming is, of course, that part of the field, the driving motivation for a lot of the field is to try and overcome that problem. But anyway, here's a closed world proof. So I know P of A, I know P of B. I'm giving you some variables now, so this is not strictly propositional. So I'm saying P of X is true if Q of X is true. And then I want to be able to show it's not true that Q of C is true. So Q of C is some specific thing, and I'm saying things in general about P of X and Q of X. This is a specific A and a specific B. So intuitively, you don't really think Q of C is true, right? Because I know P of A is true and P of B is true. And the only way I can infer Q of anything is if P of something is true. And I only know P of A and P of B, so Q of C isn't true from this set of axioms, right? At least by that form of reasoning. Okay, but we have to prove it. So we say, okay, suppose Q of C, let's take Q of C, and let's see if I can't prove it. I can't prove it. If this guy doesn't work, if I do the exhaustive search and can't prove this, then this is true, right? So now I do the exhaustive search. So now I try to prove Q of C. I'm going to search for a proof. Okay. You're going to have to trust me on the exhaustive search and applying the proof rules, just from memory from the proof rules from last time. But trust me, these are the only rules we can apply. So if I want to prove Q of C, I can pick up, the only way I can do it is by the implication P of C implies Q of C. That's using that rule, right? That gives me P of C implies Q of C. That's in here, instantiating the X to C. And now, second part of that proof is I need to prove P of C. And actually, that's the only way I'm going to be able, from this set of axioms, to get Q of C, because it's the only thing that concludes Q. Okay? And I can't establish P of C. I've got P of A, I've got P of B. There's nowhere I can search for a proof using this one. I can't do it. I mean, if you don't believe me, go away, take the set of proof rules, try it. It will work. So that doesn't work. So that means that this bit doesn't work, which means that doesn't hold. The little red lines mean I failed. Which means that doesn't work. Whoops. Which gives me that one. Okay? The only slightly tricky bit for your brain is you're kind of looking for a proof of a negation by failing to find the proof of the positive thing that's being negated. That's all. So I couldn't find, gee whiz, I couldn't find it. Therefore, the thing I'm negating must be true. Mm. Sorry, they pointed the thingy at you. Sorry, this is not meant to do that.
It's not equivalent to saying that the negation of Q of C is actually an element of the first
group of axioms. You mean, so saying that negation should appear in the set of axioms or something like that? Not quite, for reasons I'll explain in the next slide. Because there is a bit of a problem with this particular way. Oh, sorry, one.
If we replace not Q of C with Q of C, we can't solve the problem if we want to demonstrate that not Q of C.
If you do the inverse way.
Yeah,
no. Yeah. Well, wait a minute. I think we're touching on something that's going to come up in the next slide. So there is a potential defect to this. So here's one that's going to give you a result you don't want to see, and I want to explain to you why it gives you the result you don't want to see. So this, what I just showed you, is actually a tremendously powerful thing to be able to do, and is the basis for many, many languages that use negation by failure, because it gives you one single rule to deal with negation. But sometimes the assumptions end up not working the way that you might think that they would work. Because you're relying on something to do with search in order to define what something that otherwise we thought of as being just a pure positive proof of negation is. Okay. So let me show you. So here we have P of A and Q of B, and we want to show P of X and not Q of X, right? I'll show you a proof of that. Okay, so first thing I do is I say, okay, from P of A and Q of B, let's try and prove P of X. Okay, so that's P. It's an AND, so I have to do both sides of the AND, right? So I do P of X, and then I try and do not Q of X, right? That's okay, good proof step. Yeah. Okay, so P of A is in P of A and Q of B. I think I was a bit clever about this. Yes, I was. So now, the X is an A, right? Because it bound the X. Let me go back and forward again, see if I can do this. There. So here's the step where I want to establish P of X. And P of A would match the X, right? So that's P of A is in there. So that X is an A, so is that one, and so is that one, and so is that one, right? Because it's the same X, okay? Happy about that? Okay, so now my subproof is P of A and Q of B, and it's not Q, I have to establish not Q of A. And that's not provable. So I can't show Q of A. So I want to show that it's not true, sorry. I want to show that it's not true that Q of A is there. Q of A is in there, so that fails. That guy failed, so this guy succeeds, so this guy succeeds, right? So I've got a proof. Yippee. Isn't that good? So, okay, let's do another slightly different proof. And what I'll do here, remember this was P of X and not Q of X originally when I did it. The A just came in as I did the proof. It was the instance that I took for the X. Now let's do the same thing, but instead I'll turn it the other way around. I'll say not Q of X and P of X. And ands are symmetrical. It doesn't matter which side of the and you sit on. So this guy means the same thing as this guy did when this was an X, right? So let's do it. Let's do this proof now. P of A and Q of B, and I want to show not Q of X. And I can't. So now I want to be able to show that I can't prove Q of X, but I can prove Q of B. Right, there is Q of B is in there. So that guy fails, and I failed that proof. But that can't be right, because here's a proof that succeeded when this was an X, and the same proof, just changing the order on the end, failed. You can go, if you don't believe me, just go away and check it through it yourself and do the steps, good bit of practice. Why? Because of the way we're dealing with the bindings of the variables and the ordering of the ands in here. If you didn't instantiate the X to the X to the A, you have to do some other, but you do need to have some way of being able to prove this. If you didn't instantiate the X to the A, then you would end up in the same position as here, which would solve that problem. But the trouble is, usually what you're doing in practice when you're looking for these proofs is you do want the binding. There actually, this takes us on to something. Actually, and if you can park that one for, if I do a lecture on logic programming, I'll show you a language which delays the binding. I was saying that logic programmers struggle with this exactly this issue. I'll show you a way that we actually do things with it. Okay, but the only point I'm making is that you're doing some, for now, if some of this seems a little bit mystifying, the only point I'm making is just what it said on the says on the slide. When you're doing a negation with failure, you do need to know that you have to handle it with care. Okay. So for the last bit, I'm going to have to go reasonably quickly. Okay, so perceptrons. Okay, negation is going to appear in this particular problem, but mostly I'll just be showing you something about how to model perceptrons this way. So suppose what we want to do is to answer that question about can perceptrons behave like logical connectives? Okay, here's one way of doing this. So first thing we'll do is we'll have a bunch of predicates that give us the weights and the thresholds and the inputs and the output values. So this, what this says is a possible weight for my perceptron inputs is anything from minus 2 to 2. You could set a different range, whatever you want, but I'm going to set this range. All of these different weights. And here are all my, I'll give you the ranges for all the thresholds. It's discrete values, because I'm working with a discrete logic now. Something where I have to say, this is true, this is true, this is true. So this is not so far off propositional logic, right? There's a bit of structure in here, but in fact, this is saying specific instances of things that are true. Bang, 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 bang. So, and the way you understand this is not that it has that weight, but it's a possible weight. Okay, and this is a possible threshold. And these give the possible values for the inputs. It can be 0 or 1. Okay. And then what I'm going to do is define what a perceptron is using this information. So a perceptron takes the set of inputs, the threshold, and gives you the output. So in a way, this is acting like a function. If I had a functional language, this would be the output of the function. Except it is relational, because there are many, many possible different, well, there's two possible different outputs dependent. So then what happens is, So what happens is that's true if I can take the sum of the weights for the input set. I'll explain that one in a moment. The value for that expression, sum of the weights, is S, sum of the weights minus the threshold. And here's the bit where I do the step function. Really, I'm just carrying across. Actually, maybe it's easier if I see this. Sum of the weights, subtract the threshold, 0 and 1 is, let's go right back if I can. Actually, maybe easier this way. Here it is. This is the definition. Inputs, weights, threshold. Here's the expression. I'm taking the sum of the weighted inputs, and then I apply the thresholding function. Okay? There. All right? Happy about that? That's how I define a perceptron, and that is implication. That I have a perceptron of this form if I can satisfy these things. Maybe I'm setting this range a bit big. Okay. So now we want to be able to say what it means to have the required outputs for perceptrons. So guess what? This looks just like one of the truth tables that you saw in the second lecture, right? So instead of true and false, I have zeros and ones. So here are all the possible values for I1 and I2. Here's conjunction, so think of 0 as false and 1 as true. So it's false all the time unless they're both inputs are true, then it's true. Or it's the other way around, it's true all the time unless both inputs are false. Negation inverts about that. And if you don't understand how that truth table works, go back and do your homework. Really, really, you need to work. All right. So way I've described that is to say, required means this is a required behavior for a particular type of circuit. So this says it's required for an AND component that for zero, whatever, it doesn't matter what the weight is, so if I've got a zero here with whatever the weight is, a zero here, whatever the weight is, I want a zero output. If I've got a one here, a 1 here, I want a 1. So basically all this is doing is saying this set is the inputs, and you've got two inputs for each of these components. This is the output that I want to have, and I want to have all of these required outputs. Okay. So now here's my definition of a valid perceptron, and this is the bit that's going to turn your brain to jelly, I hope, if you're a normal person. Don't worry if it turns your brain a little bit to jelly. But this is the sort of game that people often play with these kinds of things. I just want to show you the game that people play with these things. So now what I want to be able to say is, what does it mean to be a valid perceptron, one that is preserving the behavior of one of these components? So P is the flag for the type of component we want, like AND. So see here we've got the required P. Here it's AND. Okay, I could have done a similar one for OR or NOT or whatever. It would just have been a different set of definitions, right? Oh, but the important thing is they must all hold, right? All of these properties must hold of your perceptron or it isn't modeling the logical connective. Okay, so I got a valid perceptron of a given type, given the weight. Here's a weight for one input, weight for the second input. And T is the threshold. That will be true if, and now here's the bit where I choose some weight. So if I've got a weight W1, a weight W2, whatever those weights are, remember I defined a whole set of them. I've got some threshold, remember I just defined a whole set of thresholds. And now here's the bit where I'm using negation, and I'm using it twice. That's the bit that turns your brain to jelly. So it's not true that I can find some input I1, remember that's 0 or 1, find some input I1, some input I2, and I've got a perceptron that gives me the output for that. That was my perceptron definition. And it's not true that I meet one of the required values. That's the bit that's supposed to turn your brain to jelly. So let me explain to you again in a different way. Why did I describe it that way? It's because I want to use the negation as failure to force the set, to force the proof to look over all the possible required characteristics. So this will be true if any one of those required things doesn't work out, right? Any one of them is enough to make this be true. So if I can find one, then I'm here. And I don't want that to happen. So that's that, why you've got that negation. And the effect of this, if you were actually doing this proof, and you were using negation as failure, is it would force it to look through all of the possible combinations of thresholds and weights and inputs, attempting to make sure that looking for a case which would falsify this condition. And if no case does falsify that condition, you have searched essentially the entire space of behaviors of your component and the condition didn't hold. So you better be sure you modeled the component correctly and you included all the conditions and so on. Okay? If you do that, and logic programs, the audience will be thinking, I could write a logic program that did that. More or less, that translates direct onto a logic program if you're interested in that kind of thing. Doesn't matter if you're not. If you do that, then you will find that actually for an AND, there is a valid perceptron. Actually, there are quite a lot of valid perceptrons that you get with different weights and thresholds that will give you the AND behavior. So here's one. If you have 1, 1, and 1.5 for a threshold, you get the AND behavior. Here it is. You can go away and work it through, but that's what happens. Okay. You can do the same for OR and NOT if you are that way minded. Okay, so here's another question. Suppose you had another component. Actually, there's not much time to do this. Actually, we won't have time really to finish this. So I'll just skim through this bit. So another question you could ask is for exclusive OR. So exclusive OR is, you know, normal OR if either or both of the two sides of the OR is true, then the OR is true. For exclusive OR, it's either but not both. So you're excluding it, so you get false if they're both true. Right? So one is true or the other is true, but not both. So that's different. And you see the difference here. So with OR, if one is true and the other is true, then you would get a true here. But exclusive OR, it's a false. Could you get that one? And if you actually do the proof, the answer is no.